From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a lesson in saving an iconic piece of a Detroit neighborhood, the reinvention of struggling Marygrove College.
People coming together saying, we can't let this happen in this community. Not now, not with all the progress that has been made in Detroit.
Looking back on lessons learned from the next idea.
My favorite stories are the places that you'd least expect innovation, that you really see people doing a lot of imaginative things.
An art project using Detroit liquor stores as theater.
Spinning this little world is what I think of it, spinning a little world around a world that's there already.
Why so many of those Olympic ice skaters have been training in Metro Detroit.
Well, I think one of the reasons we're more global today than we were is that we've got coaches that have immigrated from all over the world to set up shop, if you will, in Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The wolf was at the door from Marygrove College. After nearly a century, the small liberal arts college in Northwest Detroit was literally drowning in debt, enrollment shrinking. The only option appeared to be selling off the iconic English Gothic buildings on 53 wooded acres in hopes of paying off the debt. That would have left an enormous hole in Detroit's Bagley and Fitzgerald neighborhoods. But Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here to tell us there will be a new chapter for this 91-year-old college, and how it came together is a lesson in helping vulnerable urban institutions reinvent themselves. Daniel, full disclosure here, my mother graduated from Marygrove in 1943. I went to the Catholic High School, Immaculata, that was on the corner of Marygrove's campus. We were married. We had a reception at Marygrove in 1976. And when I heard that news last fall that the college had been forced to eliminate the undergrad program, boy, that hit hard. It seemed like it was a death knell. But there's a rescue to talk about?
Yeah. It's in process as we speak. The papers are being shuffled around to convey the ownership of the campus, my understanding, to a conservancy by the end of the week, the Marygrove Conservancy, which was legally established in September. The Conservancy will own those properties and take that debt off of the books of the college, which will make things a little easier financially for the college. So that's just step one. Step two is the Kresge Foundation has been essentially paying the bills for the college last fall semester, which was the final undergraduate semester. They paid a lot of the carrying costs just to make sure payroll got met and other things. All told, they think they got about $16 million in the college so far. Their board is asking them what they think it's going to cost to continue this rescue, and the answer they're getting right now is we're not sure. So it's kind of open-ended at this point. Also, the Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, who founded the college in 1927 on those 53 acres, originally it was a little larger, but those 53 acres there in Northwest Detroit, have put up about $10 million in loans and guarantees from their investment fund.
So why did these two stakeholders, the IHM Nuns and Kresge, why was this important enough for them to put this much money into it?
I think there are two principal reasons that you have to kind of disaggregate. When it comes to the sisters, for them, it was about their mission and it was about their history. They were committed to Detroit. They were committed to helping more disadvantaged people in Detroit. Under their leadership, Marygrove essentially became the only predominantly African-American small liberal arts college in the state. Also, starting in the particularly in the 60s and into the 70s, it was predominantly serving women and African-American and lower-income women. So they were committed to what they believe is the social justice of keeping that institution alive in that part of that city at this time. Kresge, on the other hand, looked at it as an institution that needed to survive for some of those reasons, but more importantly in some ways, because of what an important piece it was of the neighborhood and the plans for neighborhood revitalization. It's just down the road from the University of Detroit Mercy. It's part of a larger ecosystem that the City Hall has looked at and said, we think this is one of the neighborhoods that can be revitalized because it has these institutional pieces there that can be built around them. And if one of them goes dark, or has to be sold off. I mean, the last thing a bank wants to do is have that asset on its books and then have to pay to secure it and maintain it and figure out what the heck they're going to do with it and how they're going to get some of their money out of it. Comerica Bank and no other bank wants to hold on to that. They'd much rather see it in a productive way as long as, you know, the financials work. So I think Kresge stepped in, and this is part and parcel of the way they've been operating when it comes to Detroit. They have enough of a record today that they're a leader. So they bring two things, I think, to these kinds of things. One is conceptual thinking. They've got teams that work on their Detroit team, a social investment team that look at how can we affect change and improve the situation and take an asset and build upon it for its next life or its next iteration. And the other thing they bring, of course, is capital. They got ideas and dough. And I think that puts them in a position where they're able to lead, and given the track record that they have.
Kresge's going to be kind of driving this new iteration. The IHMs are what putting that money in to kind of keep things going. And Kresge can drive the next chapter for Marygrove. So what do they see as their vision for this new iteration of Marygrove?
I would push back slightly on that. Kresge is one piece in that. The Conservancy has a board, and this gets very detailed and arcane, but essentially the board is comprised of four different entities. People that represent the college, people that represent the neighborhood, Sister Jane, the head of the IHM, is, I believe, going to be the chairman of the board, and Kresge. And also, I think, on that board is the president of UD Mercy, Antoine Garibaldi. So, I mean, there's a real attempt here to say, okay, this isn't just us driving this as Kresge, or this isn't just us as the sisters driving this. This is all of us trying to coalesce around an idea. And to answer your question more specifically, I think one of the things that they all tend to agree upon is this is going to have an educational mission. Whatever's going to be here next is going to have an educational mission. One of the things I heard most in my reporting was P20. P20 defined as in a central location, a preschool to an elementary school to a high school to potentially undergraduate all the way to graduate school, all in one location. And that it could be a model for urban education that could be replicated around the country, and how that institution can then be a part of neighborhood revitalization. Because what's happened to Marygrove is not unique to Marygrove. There are a lot of small liberal arts colleges around the country that are challenged financially. A lot of them do not have large endowments. They depend on enrollment to make their finances work. And if they start to have problems and enrollment starts to plunge, at Marygrove, between 2013 and 2016, undergraduate enrollment went from a little bit over 1,000 to under 500, dropped like 50% in 3 years.
Not sustainable.
They also had situations where a lot of the students didn't decide that they were going to come to Marygrove until right before classes started. So they had no idea what kind of money they were going to have for the coming year in terms of revenue. A lot of times they didn't have a sense until the end of September to get a sense about what their revenue picture was going to look like for that semester. That is a very hard way to plan. My college, my liberal arts college that I went to and my daughter went to, is a little more stable. They've got a much bigger endowment, more stable incoming classes, et cetera, et cetera. But schools like Marygrove are very challenged, and as they stumble, and they will, what will happen to them? How can those properties be reused in a way that is beneficial to the community? Whether it's a small town in Ohio or it's Northwest Detroit, it's kind of the same question. And I think what Kresge is trying to get at is say, hey, can we put together a model with the community, with U of D Mercy, with the sisters, that works for this part of town?
And then lessons that can be taught to other institutions, other cities in Michigan, other states.
That's exactly right. I mean, as Marygrove went through this process, they had a higher education consultant come in and look at the operations. And that consultant came back with a report that, from my understanding, was very critical and very hard to read. Officially, they will not release that report. They'll talk about it in generalities. Mm-hmm. But I think what it did was it confirmed why they were in the position that they were in, and that they could not sustain the business going forward. And I talked to the chairman of the board, who said that was very helpful to the board in helping to crystallize what some of the decisions were and some of the issues were, and put data around some of the issues that they could eventually move forward. And I think it's important to note here that this has been very difficult for a lot of people. They cut their faculty by almost 75%. In this process, they declared what's called financial exigency, which is kind of a higher academic term that is somewhat akin to bankruptcy, in the sense, not as a legal process, basically saying we can't pay the bills. And what that enabled them to do was to pierce the veil of academic tenure. So tenured professors who thought they had jobs for life found out they didn't. And because the college said, we're declaring financial exigency, and that was very difficult. It's difficult for students. Kresge's come forward and put together a transition fund of about $1.2 million, I think it is, that will be available, I think, starting this month for some students. Many of them have been placed and have moved on to other institutions. But it's been very difficult. I mean, nobody takes any joy in this. And I think the one thing that is positive is that the institution, it looks like, is going to get a shot at a second life. Now, what that's going to look like now, we don't know yet. And I don't get the sense that the people involved in it really know exactly. I think they know directionally where they want to go, and they know that they want it to be an educational institution. But what exactly it looks like is TBD.
When you stop and think about how this all comes together, and you pointed out in your front page story in today's news, a coalition comes together to help unwind all the financial problems and then kind of point that legacy institution to a more modern and hopefully more productive direction. Lessons learned from the Detroit bankruptcy?
This is a very familiar Detroit story. An institution that kind of evokes the golden age of Detroit that a lot of people remember with fondness did not collapse overnight. This is something that had been coming for many, many years, and eventually it hits a tipping point. And then it starts to happen very fast. And then people who out in the community step forward and say, we've got ideas, or we can't let this happen. In the case of General Motors, it was the federal government that said, we can't let this happen. In the case of the bankruptcy, it was foundations. It was the chief mediator, Jerry Rosen. It was a lot of other people that came together and crafted what became the grand bargain, which we've talked about many, many times.
Yes.
And this, I think, is of a piece with that. I mean, it's the same kind of people coming together saying, we can't let this happen in this community, not now, not with all the progress that has been made in Detroit. And if we can step forward and help repurpose, redirect, reimagine Mary Grove, we got to do it.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, Liquor Store Theater, a series of short films challenging the ideas of theater space and performance in Detroit.
You know, we discuss everything from graffiti to economics to politics to places and spaces that are important to them.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Two Japanese figure skaters who train in Metro Detroit have had their Olympic moment.
Representing Japan, Miyu Suzaki and Ryuichi Kihara.
Japan's Miyu Suzaki and Ryuichi Kihara finished 21st in the pair skating short program. Unfortunately, not good enough for them to make finals. The couple train at the Detroit Skating Club in Bloomfield Township. We spoke with them and some of their trainers back in December as part of our Am I Curious project. And in honor of their performance in Pyeongchang, let's revisit that conversation.
Am I Curious?
Am I Curious?
Am I Curious?
Time for Am I Curious, where you ask the question and we dig up the answer. Here's today's question.
This is Dan Major from Clinton Township, Michigan, and I'd like to know why so many international Olympic figure skaters train in Metro Detroit.
To find the answer, we turn to the Detroit Skating Club in Oakland County in Bloomfield Township. It's one of several facilities in Michigan that turn out big-named Olympic skaters, names like Tara Lipinski, Federica Faela, Massimo Scali, Virginia Baxter, to name just a few. Jared Swallow and his skater partner and wife, Elizabeth Punsellen, are five-time U.S. national champions in ice dancing, and they competed twice in the Olympics. These days, Jared Swallow is the managing director of the Detroit Skating Club. Jared, welcome.
Hi, Cindy. Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
And Yuka Sato skated for Japan in two Olympics. She was a world champion, and these days she's a national, international, world, and Olympic coach and choreographer for the Detroit Skating Club. Yuka, good to have you with us.
Hi, Cindy.
Thanks for having me.
It's exciting to talk to you, and I'll say I am a skating fan, so I'm personally having a very happy moment as I get to talk to two tremendous skaters. So, Jared, how did this come to be that Michigan is such a strong training ground that brings athletes from around the world? When and why did that happen for Michigan?
Well, I think one of the reasons we're more global today than we were is that we've got coaches that have immigrated from all over the world to set up shop, if you will, in Detroit. And with that, they've attracted an international level of athletes to come and train in Detroit. So compared to when we were training, we're much more global than the 90s, for sure.
Indeed. And the Detroit Skating Club isn't the only club in Michigan where top-tier skaters train. What are some other clubs in Michigan are hotspots for these world-caliber skaters?
We're very lucky. The coaches that have migrated to the state over several decades, they stay because we have facilities that can give them the time and the resources necessary to develop Olympic-level skaters. We've had coaches, actually, that have moved away from our club, and they developed their own programs. One is very successful in Canton, Michigan, at Arctic Edge Figure Skating Club, and also at the Novi City Rink. It's incredible that we have three major training centers within a 45-mile radius, and they attract skaters from all over the world. So it really has become a mecca for training figure skaters to the Detroit area.
Jared, how many international Olympic figure skaters and ice dancers are training right now at the Detroit Skating Club?
Well, Cindy, we have, leading into the Korean Olympic Games, let's see, probably four skaters that have a chance to make the team. One couple in particular from Turkey will have already qualified, so they'll be there. And then we have some young up-and-coming U.S. skaters that have a very good chance. We also have a Japanese pair team that will most likely be competing in Korea for the Japanese team event.
So, Yuka, give us the names of the Japanese pair team you're teaching so we can follow them along with their progress and say, okay, these are skaters from the Detroit Skating Club.
Yes, the pair team that I teach, their names are Miyu Suzaki and Ryuichi Kihara from Japan.
And to help answer Dan's Am I Curious question, we asked Miyu Suzaki and Ryuichi Kihara just what brought them from Japan to the Detroit area.
My name is Miyu Suzaki. I'm 17 years old.
I'm Ryuichi Kihara. I'm 25.
Right now, we train for Japanese national and Hope Olympics. We don't have ice rink in Japan, and we can't practice in Japan, so we came here. They have ice rink and gym and also dance studio, so that's good for us.
There is good coach.
This has to be exciting for you, Yuka, having been on that Olympic journey yourself, and now there you are helping lead these athletes forward on their Olympic path.
Yes, I got to experience the best part of the both worlds, one from being in the United States for the past about 20 years of, you know, living here, working full-time, and being able to work with a lot of American skaters. And at the same time, you know, I still get the taste of supporting right behind the Japanese team.
Yuka, when an international skater says, all right, I'm going to come and train with Yuka Sato, I'm going to the Detroit Skating Club, and I'm going to move halfway around the world, do they do it on their own? Do they come in groups? Do they come with family or training partners? How do you see it work out?
I think it varies really dependent on the situation and the people. Sometimes it's one of those things, timing is everything. Just one person comes and then there are a whole bunch of group of people come. It's sort of like following that one person. And sometimes the whole family moves. The Japanese team, the boy who skates, he is 25 years old, so he's here by himself. But his partner, who is only 17, her and her mother came together. So there's a lot of family sacrifices sometimes is to be made in order for the skaters to continue and to achieve their goals.
Yuka, you are a world champion. You are an Olympian from Japan. What made you decide to come coach in Michigan?
It's sort of my fate that I've always had close friends living or going to University of Michigan or some sort that I tend to have a lot of good relationship with this area, which wasn't by my choice, but it was very interesting. And, you know, the reason I'm still here is because of such a wonderful facility that I get to work in, which is Detroit Skating Club. I've taught here for many, many years, but also I've had such a great professional career as a performer. And I can say for both as a coach and a skater, this facility is just so wonderful. We have freedom of having a great quality of training sessions for the skaters. And also we have off-ice aspect of it with the trainers, physical therapist, and some of the other instructors that figure skating need for dance classes and the strengthening, conditioning, and everything is happening under one roof. So for the athletes, it's just wonderful, and also at the same time for the developmental group to be introduced to the sport.
Yuka Sato, 1994 Ladies World Champion, two-time Olympic competitor, and she is a national, international, world, and Olympic coach and choreographer at the Detroit Skating Club. And Jared Swallow, five-time U.S. national champion and ice dancing two-time Olympic competitor, the managing director of the Detroit Skating Club. It's been a pleasure to talk with both of you, and thank you so much for helping us out with Am I Curious?
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you.
We recorded this conversation back in December when Japanese skaters Miyu Suzaki, Ryuichi Kihara, and other Detroit Skating Club athletes were preparing for the PyeongChang Winter Olympics. If you've got a question for us to dig into, just submit it to us on the Am I Curious page at michiganradio.org. An exhibition currently running at the Cranbrook Art Museum in Bloomfield Hills will challenge your idea of just what a theater is. Rather than an ornate performance space, like, let's say, the Detroit Opera House or Orchestra Hall, this exhibition shows that a not-so-typical space can indeed be a theater, in this instance, a liquor store. The exhibition is titled Maya Stovall Liquor Store Theater Performance Films. Maya is a Detroit artist and a brand new PhD in cultural anthropology and performance studies from Wayne State University. Starting in 2014, she held a series of dance performances outside liquor stores in her McDougal Hunt neighborhood on Detroit's east side. And she would engage and talk with passersby and store customers, all of it on film. And it's those films that make up this exhibition at Cranbrook.
Even this corner we're standing on, this used to be the Wild, Wild West. I mean, anything and everything was happening on this corner. But it seems to me that things change. Things are changing in our city.
Maya Stovall is here with us. Now, Maya, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we have Laura Mott here, who's curator of contemporary art and design at the Cranbrook Art Museum. Laura, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So what was it, Laura, about the liquor store theater performance films that when you saw them, they felt like a good fit for Cranbrook?
Well, there's a current suite of exhibitions of four solo shows, two very venerable, famous artists, Jean-Marcel Basquiat and Keith Haring, and contemporary artist Ryan McGinnis. And Maya was the fourth artist that joined this group of artists because these were all artists who are working, in the street in this relationship between art and life. And Maya was really, for me, she's part of this really important art historical legacy of artists working against the surface of the street. If you look at how Basquiat or Haring would do graffiti or do these kind of mark making, I feel like Maya, and using dance and theory and ethnography, she's part of this conceptual thinking, but also this ephemeral mark making. And I kind of see her as essentially like etching this work into the memory of people on the street, people who happen upon these performances. And it's also part of, a mission, I think, of Cranbrook Art Museum and of contemporary art to really be supporting and looking at artists who are really challenging the forms in which people are creating, and Maya is an incredible example of that.
Maya, I saw where you've described liquor store theater as a choreo-ethnographic project. What does that mean?
The work is, it's equally contemporary art and equally ethnography. And what ethnography means, it's anthropology speak for a close study of some group of people. So in my case, I was meditating on this neighborhood called McDougal Hunt, this little tiny slice of Americana on Detroit's East Side. So my ethnographic subject is the neighborhood and, of course, the people who are in the neighborhood and who are passing through. And at the same time, it's equally a bizarre, surreal, weird project unfolding on the street.
And this is a neighborhood you know very well.
Yeah. It's the neighborhood where I also live. And over the course of the project, I decided to focus on the 8 liquor stores in the, it's less than half a square mile in land area, the neighborhood with 8 liquor stores. And I became fascinated by this when I moved to the neighborhood a couple years before I started the project. And for me, the technical definition of theater even, you know, includes the idea of drama, the idea of text, and the idea of movement, you know, choreography in the sense of not in a narrow definition, but in a definition that's broad, series of actions, right? Some kind of action. So the theater was already there, in other words. In this project, the philosophical sort of backdrop is that the theater is already there, not in regard to this neighborhood in a particular way, but that when there are spaces where people gather anywhere in the world, there's a theater already there, and I'm really interested in that.
So when we watch these films, Maya, we see you and several other dancers performing a very slow, thoughtful blend of ballet and jazz dancing in the parking lots of liquor stores. And then, as cameras roll, you talk to people from the community who come by and they see you dance. What are you talking to them about? What do they say to you?
Yeah, so I guess it's important to say I don't invite anyone to sort of speak with us until they have absorbed and been on the scene and seen the performances. And that's really important. So we're sort of like spinning this little world is what I think of it, spinning a little world around a world that's there already, the people who are there already. And so then I'm asking people really questions like, tell me about Detroit. Tell me about the neighborhood. What's going on in the city? And then toward the end of the project, I started asking people, you know, what's going on in the United States right now? You know, what's going on in the world that you're interested in? So the questions I keep really focused, and then I just let the person who I'm speaking with guide me really as we sort of, and then, you know, we discuss everything from graffiti to economics, to politics, to places and spaces that are important to them. Everything sort of comes up.
So as you did this, Maya, what most surprised you?
The surprise. That's the thing. The surprise, if I had to say what is the most sort of recurring thing, actually the most recurring thing is the surprise. There was always the surprise. You know, there's a person who's just walking by, an unassuming person, and then you ask them a question about city life, and they start waxing philosophical, and they start, you know, winding you through worlds of history and memory around, you know, places and spaces in the neighborhood, you know, over the past 20 years. You know, the surprise is constant. You know, people come up to you and ask you, do you know about John Lee Hooker? He's from this area, you know. The one thing that's, I guess, the most consistent thing is the surprise. And that, for me, is what I'm really interested in as an artist, is, you know, spinning this little world where I can meditate on those little sparks and those surprises that really make us all tick.
Laura Mott, am I correct? Karen Brook actually commissioned a film?
Yes.
Why did you do that commission?
Well, commissioning new work from artists is a way that museums can support new ideas and generating new work. In part, it's always a little bit of an experiment because you don't know what's going to happen. But at the same time, I think, you know, we're part of the Metro Detroit area. It's really important that we are investigating our city. And, you know, Maya's investigations into her neighborhood, they speak very much directly to our city, but also to, you know, really this idea of how people bring ideas on top of Detroit. And this was a way for Maya to create a work that is now traveling the world. It's at Krimbogart Art Museum, but the same piece is being shown internationally now. It's a way for Detroit to speak for itself. And it's a really incredible intersection, I think, of, you know, creating new important contemporary artwork, but also really engaging in the international conversation that happens around our city.
What kind of response have you seen as people watch the films?
The response has been incredible because what this exhibition does is it's a trigger for conversation. So people come and they watch, and then you see them speaking to each other. They talk about their own experiences of the city. They talk about how they understand the place of McDougal Hunt. They talk about, they feel like they've met the people that Maya has met. It's really a wonderful way of engaging in the city through artwork.
Maya Stovall Liquor Store Theater Performance Films will be running until March 11th at the Cranbrook Art Museum in Bloomfield Hills. Laura Mott with Cranbrook, and artist and new PhD Maya Stovall. Congratulations on that, and thank you so much to both of you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Up next, what should we in 2018 remember and learn from Francis Galton and eugenics?
We really are all part of the same race, the human race, and we have to be very careful to judge our science from pseudoscience.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This week marks the 196th birthday of someone who occupies a place of dishonor in the annals of science. Sir Francis Galton was born this week in 1822. He was interested in a wide range of fields, meteorology, psychology, biometrics, and more. But it was his social theories on eugenics that left an unsavory, unhappy mark on the world. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is here to explain. Now, Galton coined that term eugenics. We've heard it, but what is eugenics?
Yeah, so it's in a book called Inquiries into the Human Faculty and Its Development. And eugenics really comes from two Greek roots, and it means noble in birth. You is noble, genics in birth. Mm-hmm. And what he wanted to do is favor the hereditary traits of people that were noble, intelligence or strength or good character, things that he thought were inherited that we know are not necessarily inherited, and get those people who showed those traits to reproduce in great numbers, and people who had less noble traits, also judged by an armchair British nobleman as what was noble and what was not noble, to not reproduce so much. And that became a huge theory, particularly among white Anglo-Saxon Protestants on both sides of the Atlantic. It spread like wildfire.
White Anglo-Saxon Protestants who felt they certainly were in the superior class.
They were the highest of all births, and others were not. And many of us who are listening or even discussing this would find ourselves probably on the outs as not so noble in birth, yes. And completely subjective, by the way, and not at all really scientific.
So did it make a splash?
It did. That book and then several other books that he wrote and papers that he wrote were adopted, embraced by scientists on both sides of the Atlantic, sociologists, political theorists, and so on. And, you know, there were a lot of great problems facing England and especially the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century. People did not know how to deal with other races. You had a lot of immigrants. You had nearly 20 million immigrants coming into the United States, flooding into the United States.
Just think of those pictures from Ellis Island.
Exactly. And you had urban unrest. You had ghettos. You had – what do you do with people who are so-called mental defects, as they called them, people with mental health challenges? The idea was to quarantine them, to cordon them off in various social schemes, even people who were blind or deaf or had physical handicaps. And so the notion that all of these were inherited and would somehow taint, I love this, the human, the protoplasm, the social germplasm of the United States, that became the golden rule, so to speak.
And in the 20th century, we had the progressives. And these reformers, were they more focused on protecting white America than truly helping the immigrants who were coming into this country?
Sadly so. And some of them, like Margaret Sanger, who is heralded as a great patron saint of birth control, but she was a eugenicist, Helen Keller, Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, as well as, you know, famous people like Calvin Coolidge, on and on and on. Teddy Roosevelt, one of my favorites, John Harvey Kellogg.
Henry Ford.
And it was all about protecting the white race from degeneracy. And it wasn't just immigrants. It was African Americans or people from the Appalachian mountain chain and on and on and on. Anyone who was considered to be less than. And there were all sorts of mandatory sterilization laws. And most telling, you mentioned immigrants, the Immigration Restriction Act of 1924, which rolled back the quotas to 1890 and specifically cordoned off people from Eastern Europe, Eastern European Jews, Southern Italians, people from the Balkan states, Greece, and so on, because they would not fit in. They would not be assimilable. And think about how many millions of people who died in the Holocaust who might have escaped if the gates were not shut to American doors between 1924 and 1964. It just boggles the mind.
Do we have any direct links as far as how much eugenics influenced Adolf Hitler?
Ah, Adolf Hitler loved the eugenicist, and there was a best-selling book by Madison Grant called The Passing of the Great Race. Madison Grant, by the way, is one of the founders of the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. And it was a huge bestseller, 1916, published by Charles Scribner's and Sons. And Adolf Hitler called it My Bible. And he used that for his master race and final solution. And it wasn't until after World War II ended that people awoke to the horrors of eugenics. And eugenics fell by the wayside, and the far more scientific genetics, which is simply the birth of people. Mm-hmm. And what is hereditary and what is not.
And not judging on what is superior and what
right.
is inferior.
Right. And nurture versus nature, which was another phrase that Galton coined, by the way, and how complicated those things are. Mm-hmm. And how they often are a blend of things.
It is kind of gut-churning as I read your essay and you talk about this progressive era and what America was like. And when you think of who was deemed inappropriate, that we don't want them reproducing, you've talked about the blind, the deaf, mentally ill, orphans, unwed mothers, epileptics, Native Americans, African Americans, foreigners, poor residents from the mountains and hollows of Appalachia. And then to hear the kinds of terms that doctors and psychologists created to new diagnoses.
Yeah. So diagnoses like being a moron, being an idiot, being an imbecile. Yeah. These are all clinical terms for people who were considered to be mentally defective.
It's just a, yeah. it's a pretty eye-opening chapter in our history. When what should we in 2018 remember and learn from Francis Galton and the eugenicists and what was happening in this country 100 years ago?
Well, I think we have to be very careful about judging one group of people over another. We really are all part of the same race, the human race. And we have to be very careful to judge our science from pseudoscience. And we have to be very careful of who we listen to and to listen very critically. But most importantly, there is not that much difference if you look at the human genomes of this group versus that group. There are so many more similarities. And so judging really ought to be off the table.
University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor, Dr. Howard Markell. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, too.
The best and the brightest.
Opportunities. The next idea.
We're going to find that these social and cultural factors really add a lot to economic growth.
Innovation, creativity. ideas that could move Michigan forward. That's what The Next Idea has been exploring since we launched it on this program back in November 2014. In those more than 3 years, we've heard from a wonderful array of innovative, creative, entrepreneurial people who have indeed made a difference in Michigan. And today, as we wrap up The Next Idea, it's fitting to spend this time with our partner, the University of Michigan's Dean of Innovation, Jeff DeGraff, and talk about what we've learned and where these ideas can lead us. Always good to have you here.
Glad to be here, Cynthia. You know, it's very funny to see how quickly the 3 years have passed. And this all started with, I gave a State of the Economy talk a number of years ago and had an interesting conversation with our friends at MEDC and some other people about, could we showcase, you know, artists and educators and community leaders and executives and entrepreneurs and inventors and clergy and everybody in our state? Because people are doing some very interesting things. And boy, you guys have done a great job. We've certainly seen a lot of those people and heard a lot of the really interesting things that people are doing to grow this state.
Well, we have to really start by thanking you for your energy, your support and ideas, and also the support from the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. So did you ever think we'd find out that there were so many people with so many creative ideas?
Well, I think that's largely Michigan radio. I mean, you know, I certainly love being supportive, but I think really it's your staff here has done an amazing job sort of finding these people. And it's always, you know, this sort of 6 degrees of separation where, you know somebody and they know somebody and they know somebody. And my favorite stories are the places that you'd least expect innovation, that you really see people doing a lot of imaginative things with very little money, with very little support from anyone, and really exhibiting a lot of that wonderful sort of ownership, that self-authorizing behavior, whatever we're going to call that, really getting things done on their own.
When you think about what we've learned from these more than 38 months of exploring ideas and creativity, I think, first off, innovation certainly is not the domain of tech-oriented white males, is it?
No. And in fact, that's radically changing. And, you know, one of the interesting things that we have to be honest about here is, you know, we were pretty far behind for a long time. We've still got a lot of catching up to do, but we've certainly made some good efforts. I don't think we're above the waterline yet, but we're certainly moving that way. We're starting to see things in the state at least to begin to sync up, and we're seeing at least the beginnings of some more inclusiveness.
And you write that we need to encourage churn, meaning what?
Well, one of the big challenges is everybody talks a good game about innovation, but you really have to accelerate the failure cycle. People talk about failure all the time, but I want you just to think about, you know, whether you're a teacher or you're a professional or you got your own business. It's really hard to go through it. So everybody kind of abstractly talks about it, but they don't really do it. Are we really willing to tolerate the kind of failure and the kind of investment and the real kind of pushing and shoving in a polite way, in a good way, that constructive conflict that really produces innovation? I think that's really the proof in the pudding. Are we really willing to do that?
You know, thinking about our Rust Belt history in this state, what does the big challenge that you think Michigan faces in taking ideas and then designing and producing them in a way that is sustainable?
One of my big points, and I've sort of harped on it, if you will, to your listeners, is that we really have to end regionalism. You know, I am a native of the state, and one of the things that I really see is Ann Arbor is one of these hotbeds for startups. In fact, it has more venture capital per person than any city in the United States. And Grand Rapids is this great, robust economy of mid-cap companies and sort of that whole western side of the state. You see Kalamazoo, Traverse City to a lesser degree. If we can get the real estate of reasonable so young people can live there, that'll be another story.
Very much.
Of course, you're seeing the comeback of Detroit with large capital. We have all the makings of a robust economy, but you have to sync them up. Whether you're looking at the Brookings Institute reports or whether you're looking at what industry leaders are doing, that needs to be dialed up. I certainly think we've made steps that way, but we certainly could do a better job with that.
Well, to that point, we should let everybody know there is an Issues and Ale, Michigan Radio Issues and Ale, coming up this Monday, 7 p.m. at Pretzel Belt in Ann Arbor, digging into this idea of all these silos when you think of, as you say, Grand Rapids in Ann Arbor and Detroit, of all these good things going on, but these silos exist. And that's what you're going to be getting into, how entrepreneurs and businesses in Detroit, Ann Arbor, and Grand Rapids can really build this regional cooperation.
Yeah, we're bringing some wonderful people who've been on, who from all three of these areas, and how to do that and have a real meaningful discussion. You know, this is a We're living in a time where I'm beginning to wonder, I don't know if your listeners are, but I'm beginning to wonder, does government even matter anymore? You know, the whole notion of the divisiveness of everything and all of the anger that doesn't produce anything constructive. And what I'm seeing is sort of at a grassroots level. I'm seeing people get together and I'm seeing people make the kind of inroads and doing the kinds of things that maybe a decade or two ago the government would have been supportive of. So, you know, I think we're maybe beginning to get into an era of we might have to do some things ourselves.
I'm talking with the University of Michigan's Dean of Innovation, Jeff DeGraff, as we kind of wrap up the next idea. Well, as we all know, Detroit didn't make Amazon's shortlist, Jeff, for its second headquarters, because according to Amazon, the region doesn't have the necessary talent pool. Have we learned anything from the next idea and how to address that problem?
I think we have. I think this is the most disappointing area over 3 years. If you were to ask me in a dark moment what was real, I'd just say education continues to be our biggest challenge. Once again, you know, it's very interesting. I teach these capstone courses at Michigan, and I have so many students who've gone off and done so well. It's very hard to keep them here. We really haven't done the kinds of things that are required. We're below the national average on bachelor's degrees. There are lots of options that people have these days. You know, careers are much more fluid. The way we treat teachers, what we've done with our schools. There's some encouraging things. The Kalamazoo Promise, I think, is encouraging, at least to some degree.
But the big picture.
The big picture is we've got to do a better job of keeping our best and our brightest at home, and we've got to do a better job at really preparing them skill-wise. I was looking before I came here at some of the kind of key numbers about where Michigan falls in terms of bachelor degrees or in terms of GDP per person or in terms of venture capital per person, and it's disappointing. And it all sort of starts with education, and then I start comparing it to places like Minnesota, Wisconsin, which are in the top quartile while we're kind of in the bottom quartile. And I see government come out with all these numbers. And I have to tell you, when I look at sort of more objective data, I'm deeply suspicious. So I think education has to be fixed.
You know, there were so many promising ideas that we have heard over these months that could really drastically improve people's learning, their health, their lives. But how do we close the gap between the people who can luckily afford to access that technology and those who are disadvantaged? They don't have the money, for instance.
I've got an interesting story around this. I'm a technologist by trade. That's my doctoral area. And interestingly enough, about 1990, I got a call from Life magazine. And they wanted to talk about innovation. I thought, wow, they want to talk to me about innovation. They actually wanted to talk about one of my great uncles who I didn't know. I didn't know this man was related to me, Robert Fair DeGraff. And he was well known for inventing paperback books. He's the guy who founded Pocket Books. And when I started looking into this guy, he made their list of the 100 most important people of the 20th century. His theory was if he made books available, cheap enough, that's a technology, everyone would read. Illiteracy would be erased in America. But of course, it wasn't. And what struck me is I had been working on a project with Steve Jobs to develop literacy in California schools using technology. And I had the exact same results. So I think it's a double-edged sword. I think, one, we have to make things like internet access and the tools for internet access, the gadgets, far more available. But I also think there's a cultural issue here. I think the cultural issue is that we also have to have a culture that thinks that engaging in these tools to better our lives, to enhance ourselves in some meaningful way is important, as opposed to distractions or the kind of things that we're finding people are doing with these gadgets. Some of the studies that have come out of the University of Pennsylvania and Stanford recently about this kind of multitasking and distraction stuff is very alarming.
Indeed. There's going to be so much that I know you're going to be covering Monday at 7 p.m. at Pretzel Bell in Ann Arbor. Again, looking at how we break out of the silos and how entrepreneurs and businesses in Detroit, Ann Arbor, and Grand Rapids can build regional cooperation. So Michigan Radio's next Issues in Ale, Jeff and some great folks, our executive producer Joel Lindstroth will be there this Monday, February 19th, 7 p.m. at Pretzel Bell. You know, Jeff, your final essay for the next idea, you pose the final question for the next idea. What is the final next idea?
The ultimate innovation is to innovate people. And I think we're the greatest work of art we can produce. I can't emphasize enough that one of the things I'm very proud of in the state of Michigan is we have some really amazing people and we've heard a lot of them. I think the real issue is how do we infect everyone with that kind of can-do attitude, that kind of I'm improving myself, I'm developing myself, I'm innovating myself. And if I innovate myself, the business I'm creating and the art that I'm creating, I really think it comes down to a few things. Culture and competency. Are we going to develop the culture and competency that's required to do this? And if anybody's ever received a correspondence from me, I sign everything vision, courage, freedom. And I think they're kind of key words here. I mean, one, I think the state needs to really have a vision of the future of some very specific areas it's innovating and what it expects from the citizenry. I think it needs to have the courage to spend the money on it. This is a big thing where a lot of times we don't. A lot of times we're more focused on cutting things than we are investing in things. We could do better. I'll leave it at that. And then finally, freedom. You know, one of the things about an entrepreneurial economy or an economy where people are expressing themselves or developing something in their lives, I think we have to be free and responsible to take that on ourselves to really grow.
Jeff DeGraff, Dean of Innovation at the University of Michigan and our partner in The Next Idea, thank you.
Cynthia, thanks to you and Joe and to Zoe and to Tamar and everybody involved. Keep moving forward, Michigan.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities, michiganbusiness.org.
Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.